Welcome to the vlog. On Youth Express. Okay, I'm done. Welcome to the Block on Youth Express, recorded live from Saturday Light Brigade Studios. This is Khalees and I'm a junior at Obama. Joining me is
Amari, I'm a senior at Shadyside.
Today we'll be discussing Breisha Meadows as well as the wiretapping case at Woodland Hills High School. But first we're going to start by talking about an update of the Dakota Access Pipeline. So not even 4 days into, 4 days into Donald Trump's presidency, he signs an executive order to advance the approval of the Keystone and Dakota Access Pipeline. Trump said that he would try to renegotiate some of the terms, which I highly doubt, or renegotiate it into his favor. He's seeking to get the pipeline built, though. The executive order gave builders permission to start moving supplies into place, not officially start building the pipelines and start all the building just to get stuff back into the place.
Basically, what we said last time, I think, stands. Make sure that you are paying attention to what's going on there. So anybody you can follow who's at the pipeline, anybody who's recording especially, make sure that you keep up with what's going on with them because they still are being brutalized from what's been put out there. And just make sure that you can support them, you know, donate whatever you can. They are still looking for money and for resources and things like that. So just support them in whatever way you can because they have a very long, probably a 4-year fight ahead of them. They need us. Our main hot topic is going to be the Women's March, which happened the Saturday after Trump's inauguration. So in D.C., there was 470,000 people who showed up. And then there was 673 sister marches, official sister marches, on the Women's March website. And so these are marches that happened all across the world, not just in the U.S., but there were a ton that happened in the U.S. There was also one that happened here in Pittsburgh. And the estimated number for the people who showed up for the over 600 sister marches was almost 5 million people total. So basically, the march originated as just women, like any woman who wanted to come and like march for her rights and kind of stand up against Trump and what he had said before the election could come. But ended up just being kind of a lot of different people who were opposing Trump coming and using the Women's March as a platform to share their message as well. And so there was a lot of controversy with the way that things were set up. There's a really good account by one of the women who was a state leader for the National March. She was a state leader for the state of Louisiana, and she did a really good piece about how the march kind of, she felt like women of color were being ostracized and how anyone who was speaking up against the national leaders was being ostracized. And there was a lot of talk about that going on. And then, but with the march actually happening, they had lots of different people come to speak. So I guess they did make at least an attempt on a visual level to kind of like combat that backlash that they were receiving. So they had activists for dozens of different causes, religious leaders, actors, founders of organizations, writers and authors, college professors, social workers, journalists, and they had the mothers of the movement there as well, which was kind of really cool to listen to their speeches. Even if you didn't necessarily support the march, to be able to see the recordings was pretty nice. And then some of the other things that came out of the march were the vagina hats that everybody had been wearing, and there was kind of a conversation around that about like what it necessarily means to be a woman. And then another conversation that I really liked that sprung from the march was talking about how the police reacted to the Women's March versus how they react to Black Lives Matter protests. So if you look online, there was a lot of pictures of the police like smiling and like taking pictures of the protesters and wearing the vagina hats and like generally having a good time. They didn't have any weapons on them really. Some of them were even not in plain clothes, but pretty dressed down, pretty comfortable. And they were set up like, it wasn't like there was lots and lots of them. And there was a lot of people saying like, oh, this is how protesting should be done. Like, look at how peaceful protests turn out when you guys don't riot and do crazy stuff. But especially in the D.C. march, the majority of the people who were marching were white women. So there was kind of a conversation around that, around how our protests are politicized and how they are seen as more dangerous, even if the behavior is exactly the same.
So you mentioned that other people use it as a platform against Trump. And I just had the question of whether you thought that was a positive or a negative, or it could be both.
I think that it is a good thing. I mean, like, I think that with it being a women's march, women are all types of people. Like, there's mm-hmm. women of different races. There's women of different religions. There's women who aren't straight. So, like, the things that people were using, like, the other identifiers that were being acknowledged at the women's march were things that affect women. Like, people talking about the Muslim ban that he was going to impose and now he has imposed. Like, there are Muslim women, and that's part mm-hmm. of, like, their experience as women, and that's part of their experience as Americans. So I feel like they can't go to a women's march and march for their rights if they're not marching for that part of their rights as well.
Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of friends that went up to D.C. for the march, probably, like, 5 or 6 of them. I guess that's not a lot, but it is a few friends that went up. And I didn't know how to view the march as a whole, and that kind of happens a lot when it comes to feminist things. I don't know whether to look at it as a space that will accept me as a black girl, and I don't know if it's a feminist march for the right, if they're fighting for the right things, like inclusive things that include like black women, Muslim women, and everything. So that was my whole confusion with it at first. But then after the whole marches, after all the marches and everything, you saw the memes come up, and it was like, black women at the marches, Muslim women at the marches, white women at the marches. And through those memes, I understood that, like, it was a good platform to use. It was a space where any type of woman could come through and get their points out. But there were people who came out and made it more of a negative type thing. There were people who came out, like, this is when it throws me off from the whole feminist term. There were people who just came out and just kept chanting, like, ma'am, Grez back and all that. And just looking at that part of it instead of, like, the whole big picture of everything. And that, a lot of the time, is what throws me off from the whole feminist thing. And I know we spoke on this in another podcast of the whole feminist versus womanist. And I don't know, like, time and time again, that's just a thing that pops up in my head when it comes to feminist things going on within, like, the movement.
I kind of felt the same way. Like, I knew people who went to the D.C. march, and then I knew people who went to the one in Pittsburgh, and, like, I chose not to participate in either because of the things that I had heard going mm-hmm. on, especially in terms of women of color being silenced. But then when I look back at a lot of the pictures, like, if it wasn't just a bunch of girls, like, wearing the, like, you know, the grabs back T-shirts and all that stuff, mm-hmm. like, it was always, like, the woman, like, the womanness of the march was very centered around, like, genitalia and, like, having kids and, like, all of those things. Mm-hmm. And I don't, like, that's not necessarily where my womanhood is rooted. Like, obviously, I've never had a child before. And, like, I mean, like, I have a vagina, but, like, there are women who don't. And so I think that, like, I don't know, it was very odd for me to kind of center womanhood and, like, solidarity amongst mm-hmm. women around that, when that in and of itself was, like, excluding women from the march. And then the whole situation with, like, what was going on with the women of color, like, I saw that they put women of color, like, in the forefront and to speak at the D.C. march. I'm not really necessarily sure if they did that here in Pittsburgh, but, like, still, I feel like that could have been a strategic move. Like, they knew that people were concerned about what was going on. And so even if those women did give amazing speeches and stuff, like, for me, supporting the cause wasn't necessarily something I felt fully comfortable doing because I wasn't sure if their intentions are pure. But mm-hmm. I do understand the women who went down there and, like, used it as a chance to get their voice out because it was really publicized. And there was a lot of journalists there. Like, everybody went to hear what the women had to say, especially with, like, just the whole, like, climate around, like, people rallying against Trump, like, mm-hmm. that got a lot of attention. And so I see why you would want to take that opportunity to get the attention. But in the same sense, like, I didn't feel like I was saying anything that somebody wasn't already going to go there and represent. So I didn't feel like my presence was necessarily, like, needed.
Again, like you said, it was more of a where do I fit into this whole thing. It was like, if I go out there and if I protest, am I just fighting for white women? Am I out here not even fighting for myself?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what, like, a big question that comes up all the time. And I'll feel bad every once in a while because I'm like, what exactly do I do for, like, women. But then I think on, like, the stuff I do for Teen Blog and, like, the podcast and how much we did for black women over the summer. But I don't know if it's just me, but as a black girl, it comes up all the time, like, where do I fit into these feminist movements?
And I think it's hard, especially for us, because, like, you have more than one thing to fight for all the mm-hmm. time. And, like, I don't necessarily feel like I can, like, fight for my womanness and ignore everything else that I have going on. Like, mm-hmm. all of that plays into who I am as a woman. And so, like, especially, like, with conversations that I've had with other girls at our school about, like, how they feel with, like, the election going on, like, it's just not the same feelings. Like, yeah. even if we are women, like, and that doesn't, like, make, not to say that they're any less scared than I am or their concerns are less valid, but they definitely have very different fears from the fears that I have. And also, like, when push comes to shove, 9 times out of 10, like, there was this guy who was holding up the sign that I really, really liked that came out of the Women's March, and it was like, so I'm going to see all you nice white ladies at the next Black Lives Matter march, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, exactly. Like, that's exactly how I felt, is that, like, black women, women of color, like, I saw a really good post from an indigenous woman who traveled to D.C., to participate in the Women's March, and they did a lot of, you know, their culture is rooted in a lot of spirituality, so they did a lot of, like, prayer and things like that. They did a mm-hmm. lot of rituals before, and there was just a lot of white women interrupting them and, like, interrupting their rituals and kind of, like, making a joke out of it and trying to, like, wear their garments and things like that. And so, like, I feel like women of color, like, show up for these things. They always show up for women, no matter what. They've always been at the forefront of the feminist movement. They've always been doing the work. But when it comes to race, when it comes to, like, socioeconomic status, sexual orientation, any of those things, like, white women don't show up for that stuff. Like, straight women don't show up for that stuff. And so it kind of makes me question, like, why should I fight for somebody who's not going to fight for me? On mm-hmm. both ends of the spectrum. Like, if it's not a give and take relationship, then, like, why am I giving?
Mm-hmm. We're going to go into our Black excellence. Starting that off, we are going to have Amari talk about Hidden Figures.
So Teen Blog went to see Hidden Figures a couple of weeks ago. And so for those of you who don't know, Hidden Figures is the story of three black women who worked at NASA. One of them was an engineer and worked really closely with building the Atlas rockets and the prototypes that came before that. One of them was the head of what they called the Colored Women Department at the time, and she oversaw all the black women who were computers. So they basically did, like, all the little, like, calculation. Well, not little calculations, because this was, like, high-level calculus, like, stuff that normal people probably can't do. And then the other one focused a lot on the calculations of actually getting the Atlas rocket off the ground and getting it into space. And so it tells, like, their story, like, their experiences at NASA, their experiences with the men that they worked with and the other white women that they worked with, their experiences, like, at home. And it also tells a really great story of kind of, like, breaking down those school barriers, which is something that we see a lot in black history, like, breaking down those barriers to be able to go to this school or to go to that school. But it also shows, like, a very clear picture of black women in the workplace, especially when you're talking about, like, the STEM field. And so I really, really liked the movie. I thought it was amazing. And I know that, like, my mother works with computers, and so it really resonated with her a lot. And it was kind of, like, sad for her in a sense, because it was sad for her to see that things really hadn't changed that much for black women in the past 50 years. But it was really inspiring for her to see, like, the women who came before her doing that work and sacrificing the things that they sacrificed so that others after them could do the same thing.
I think it's cool that young black girls got to go out and see this movie and see, like, black actresses we've seen before, like, actually portray these roles. And to just get, like, a sense of, like, feeling where you're like, I can do this if I try hard enough. Like, maybe you're good in math and you saw this and you saw the movie and, like, oh, maybe this might be something I'm interested in. It's just, I don't know, it's something you don't get a lot as a black girl, or you have to search for on your own because it's not given to you in schools. And so for there to be, like, a popular movie coming out, I mean, the movie's nominated for Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
And so for there to be a popular movie coming out that you can just go into a movie and get a history lesson about black women is, it's amazing.
we also, like, going off the topic of hidden figures, want to give a shout out to a current, like, she's not necessarily a hidden figure because we found an article about her, but her name is her name is Tierra Gwynn, and she's actually an engineer at NASA right now. So she's working in rocket structural design, and she's an analysis engineer for the Space Launch System that Boeing is building for NASA. And in the spring, she's going to be graduating from MIT with a 5.0 GPA. So shout out to her. She's Black excellence.
I'm aiming for that 5.0.
Yeah. Can't
colleges
relate,
come
but...
get me. Colleges, come at me. So next we're going to be talking about Fences, another popular Black movie that just came out. Fences is based off of an August Wilson play. Shout out to Pittsburgh real quick. I've seen Fences twice already, and I'm not the type of person who just keeps going to the movies or keeps looking up a movie to see over and over again. But Fences is a movie I'm not mad about seeing twice. So originally, I went to go see it with some of my friends, like, the weekend it came out. And then we had a field trip for school where we went to go see it. So Fences, it's a movie that portrays Black life perfectly in my eyes. We were talking about it in class after we went to go see it. And one thing that amazed me about it was how August Wilson covered so many stories. Like, depending on how you look at the movie, you can have the story of Troy, who is the main character in the movie. You can have the story of Rose, who is Troy's wife. You have another just, like, storyline of Troy and Corey, where you just see the relationship between a father and a son. And you can pick out all the different type of little things from the movie, and each story gives you a lesson into, like, Black life. Or it's always something that you can pick out and be like, that's something that's going on in my house right now. My favorite part about the whole thing was Rose, which was played by Viola Davis. I feel like she did an amazing job. I said amazing a lot for this movie, but Viola Davis was absolutely my favorite part of the whole thing. So I feel like August Wilson portrayed, like, a Black woman perfectly. He, like, portrayed how, like, the Black woman has to carry around everything for the house. Like, she has to, even though they make it seem like Troy's in charge of everything, like, he's bringing home all the money, it's still Rose that's keeping the whole family together, and it's still Rose, like, that's carrying all the weight on her shoulders and making sure everything runs smoothly. Not to spoil anything for anybody, but Troy ends up having, like, a mistress, and he gets her pregnant, and it's Rose, and the mistress dies, like, during birth or whatever, and it's Rose that steps up, and she takes care of the little girl. But during the whole, like, during that scene, I was like, is she going to take her back? And she going to take him back? And she going to take him back? But she was like, it's not okay for her to be, like, a motherless child, but you are a womanless man. And everybody in the movies was just like, oh. It was a crazy scene. And I don't know, that's what touched me the most about the movie, was how well they were able to portray a Black girl's struggle and how much she has to carry everything on her shoulders, but how Rose did it so perfectly, and she still kept everything together within that household.
I think one of the things that hit me the most about it was I went to see it on Christmas Day with my dad and my brother. And so when we were in the car, I was like, I really, like, don't know how I'm going to feel about seeing this movie because Troy is abusive and it drives me crazy. My dad was like, he's not abusive. And, like, we get 20 minutes into the movie and he's like, you were right. And so, like, later, like, the part where Troy is, like, cussing out his youngest son, like, it's a bunch of different people in the movie theater. So there was a couple of other kids, me and my brother's age, in there with their parents. And then there was a lot of older Black people in there. And there's, like, a couple of white people here and there. And so, like, they're going back and forth arguing, and there's, like, all these older Black people, like, cheering for Troy. And I had, like, I was really, like, thrown by that. I was like, he's talking so bad to his child. Like, why are you cheering for him? And so I was talking to my parents about it, and they were like, that's how parenting used to be back then. Like, you never talk back to your parents. You never question your parents. And, like, no, they weren't supposed to love you. They were just supposed to provide for you, because sometimes, like, especially back then, like, that was the most that Black people could do, is, like, work all day and put food on the table for their kids, and, like, that was it. And so I was just having that conversation with my parents. Like, I didn't really understand that at first, because I had always grown up in a household where, like, I had that emotional support from my parents. And so, like, seeing people literally, like, cheering for that type of relationship really, really opened my eyes to, like, what my grandparents went through and people older than that. And I think that it's a very important movie for younger Black people to see, and for older Black people to see, just to see the generational gap, like, and to appreciate how far we've come, like, within our own families and, like, within our own home lives.
I wouldn't even say it's something that happened between, like, older parents, because when we were talking about it in class, one of my friends, he was like, through the whole relationship with Troy and Corey, that's exactly how it is with my dad. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it and I was like, dang, man. But then he was like, he said it in like a loving way. And he talks about his dad all the time. And you can tell like he has love for his dad and his dad has love for him. But it was still like that has to be hard having some type of relationship like that. But I also like realized during the whole talk, I realized that Troy's character kind of plays into like the over-masculinity in, like, Black men. Mm. Because he was, like, he has this line, and he was, like, I don't gotta love you. It's, like, it's just my job to provide for you and everything. And it was, like, there's nothing wrong with showing emotion to your son. Like, obviously, when your son's in, like, his most vulnerable state, asking you, like, why do you not love me? Like, why did you never like me? And he says, like, I don't gotta love you. And so it's, like, it's okay. It would have been okay for Troy to just break down in that spot and be like, I like you, like you're my son, I love you or whatever. But then he came out with a tough like point of view. And through that I kinda understood like the love between it, but it was still like something through the whole movie. I was like, man, Troy's getting on my nerves. Like, why does he keep acting like this towards Corey? And when my friend said that, he was like, that's how I see it between my, like, that's how it is between his dad and him. I saw it kind of between, like, my dad and my brother. They still have, like, the tough relationship where my dad will get them in check or whatever, but my dad still shows the love. And I think that's a real important thing. Like, for Black men, just understand, like, you can show the love to your son. Like, that's not making your son a wimp. That's not making your son a punk. That's just making your son know that he is loved. And so if your son's out of hand, you got to get him back and, like, check. You got to tell him, like, this ain't how it's going to go. But if your son's at his most vulnerable state asking, like, why do you not like me? Why do you never like me? It's okay to be like, of course I love you. Of course I like you. But some things I just don't agree with.
When I was watching the movie, I did see a little bit of a resemblance, well, a lot of a resemblance between my friend and her relationship with her mom. And it also kind of really, like, highlighted to me how the cycle of abuse works in families. Mm-hmm. So, like, this was a really small line in the movie, but I don't know, it hit me a lot more when I was reading the play. Troy talks about, like, his relationship with his dad. Yeah. And the whole situation that happened with him and that younger girl that he was dating when he was a kid, and how, like, his father gave him nothing. Like, his father, like, he insinuated that his father was, like, a pedophile and, like, all this stuff, and he was like, but at least I did better than him. Mm-hmm. And, like, his father was abusive to them. Like, his father was a horrible person, but, like, Troy wasn't that much better. And so, like, I mean, he was better than his father in a way, but he still wasn't, like, that loving, that caring father, and he was still, like, damaging his kids, like, especially his oldest son. Like, the way that he treated him and talked to him throughout the movie, mm-hmm. was just kind of crazy. Like, he just came back. I mean, everybody comes back to ask their parents for money, but, like, the way he was handling it every time, I was like, dang, like, you could just...
It took Rose to say, like, just give him a couple dollars.
Exactly. Like, he would just stand there and have him in the living room and just be ragging on him in front of everybody, like, mm-hmm. for minutes and minutes and minutes at a time. Like, we get it. You never see him except on payday. Let's move on now. And so kind of just, like, that whole cycle of abuse. And I mean, like, yes, the abuse is diminished, but it's still there, and, like, how that can affect somebody, and, like, they can take it on to their kids. And so I really, like, I mean, I know August Wilson can't do it now, but, like, if there was a sequel to Fences with, like, how Corey treated his kids, or, like, how the little girl grew up in the house, like, that's mm-hmm. something that I really would have liked to see.
I'd like to see how, like, Corey and Raynell's relationship played out after, because through their, like, whole 2 minutes together, you could see, like, they were going to be partner in crimes. Mm-hmm. Like, their relationship became, like, so strong so fast. And through, like, when they were sitting on the steps singing and everything, I was like, oh, I'm about to cry. But, like, it was such – that's my favorite line, I'm about to cry. But it was such, like, a cute moment, because I've had moments like that with, like, my little brother or whatever. But the difference is, like, he just met Raynell. Like, he's heard stories about him. Raynell's heard stories about him. But, like, this is their first time actually being together, and they became that close so fast. And so that, like, if we ever get a sequel, that would be a nice story to touch on. Lastly, on Fences, I know we've been talking about it a lot, but Gabe's story was also one that I was...
Yes.
Gabe's story was one, I don't know, it touched me a lot because one of the biggest problems in the Black community with me is how sometimes we fail to acknowledge mental illness. And I've seen it within my family and everything. And, like, I could relate to Gabe's whole situation. Not to the extent of the mental illness, but just some of it. And like, they understood everything. And it was, I don't know, it was just really sad for me. But the fact that I could relate to it and I'm like, was like, Gabe needs help, but the help he was getting wasn't the help that he really needed. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, well, somebody just, like, come out and please, like, help him, because I was able to relate it to my life so much.
I think that what really struck me about Gabe, like, exactly what you said, like, I don't feel like the Black community takes mental health seriously enough. Like, every time he came on screen, everybody was laughing. And I was like, I didn't know we're in a comedy. Like, what was funny about him coming on screen and talking all the time? Like, people, especially people with, like, the type of mental illness that Gabe has, like, mm-hmm. people, like, infantilize them so much and, like, treat them like a joke. And that was really, like, making me angry throughout the entire movie, is, like, his character was there to do the exact opposite of the effect that he was having on everybody in the theater. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to say, like, everybody in the movie missed the point, but, like, everybody who was in the movie with me missed the point. Like, it was really, really frustrating me, but I appreciate that his story was told and, like, that he was in the movie. And I hope that, like, other people who saw the movie kind of, like, learned something from that mm-hmm. and was able to, like, not just, like, sympathize with him, but, like, empathize with him and kind of, like, understand, like, what he was going through and, kind of like, I don't know, learn something from him as a character, because he did have a really big piece of the play to tell, and I don't feel like his character is appreciated enough.
Mm-hmm. All right, so continuing on Black Excellence, I want to talk about the New Edition biopic.
Okay. So, my mom is the, like, a really big New Edition fan, like, her and my aunt, so I was forced to watch the New Edition biopic. I really didn't remember, like, who they were that well, but, like, by the end of the first night, I was obsessed. Like, I have literally watched all 6 hours 6 times. I'm not joking. It's that good. Like, BET.
That's a lot of hours.
Did, yes. 36 hours worth of viewing. Like, BET. The casting. Mm-hmm. The costumes, the settings, like, the music, that soundtrack, like, those actors sang every single note in that biopic. And they killed it. They killed it every single time. Mm. They worked so hard on the choreography, and you can see it. Like, I've seen videos of the original Bobby Brown videos next to what Woody McClain did, mm-hmm. and it doesn't make any sense. Like, it's literally the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. Like, down to the smallest mannerisms, like the winking.
The drop of sweat coming down.
Yes, it's that good. Like, please, I don't even know how to describe to anybody. Like, watch it. Like, follow all the actors on Twitter. I can send you some links if you want to see some more behind-the-scenes videos. Oh, it's just, goodness. It's that good. It's really that good. I don't even, okay, so, like, I should probably explain what it is. But coming back to that, like, the New Edition biopic is... For all of you who don't know, New Edition was a boy band back in the past, Whitney era, a little bit before that, 80s. And there was 5 of them, but then there was 4 of them, but then there was 5 of them again.
There was 6 of them.
And there was Bobby. No, there was 5 of them plus Bobby Brown. Like, that's how it was. Okay. And it's really beautiful. And I cried.
What part did you cry on?
Okay, so this is going to be a little bit of a spoiler alert, but, like, one of the nicest, most well-behaved, like, sweetest, purest, most talented boys in the group, once he gets older, he's, like, he's on cocaine, like, and he almost dies. And I was like, why Ricky? Like, he's done nothing to anybody. He doesn't deserve this. And it made me cry. But then also, like, I found myself feeling bad for Bobby Brown. And, like, don't hate me. Like, give me a chance to explain. Please. Because I really did feel bad for Bobby in that one scene where he took the cake out of the, like, he took the chunks of cake out, and he's sitting there with all those girls, and all he really wants is to be with his friends. Like, I mean, he should have not been immature. Exactly. He should have not been immature and apologized to them, but a narcissist is a narcissist, and Bobby needed help, and nobody was going to give him help, and I feel bad that Bobby didn't do that, but... I digress. So I would just really recommend that everybody sit down and watch it. Like, support the boys in the first part. They did amazing. They're all really, really young. Like, 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 11-year-old boys, like, slaying it. And then when you get to the next part, like, your boy from Empire, he's in there. Your boy from Hairspray, he's in there. Everybody just did a really good job. And, one of the really cool things about it was that all six members of New Edition were involved in producing and, like, writing and making the whole biopic. So it is really accurate to what happened. And they just laid it out on the table. Like, they put all their business out there. They kind of embarrassed themselves. But it's okay. It's okay because it's good TV. So shout out to BET for that. Please take over on the Michael Jackson biopic, please. Please, but thank you for that. I really needed the New Edition biopic last week.
I mean, I was surprised by how good it was. There wasn't any like bad acting or anything. I think everything was flawless in it. Yeah, I didn't know any of the characters. So throughout I didn't know any of the members. So throughout like the whole thing, I was on my phone like Googling New Edition members.
Yes.
So I could put the things together. I'm 16. I'm sorry.
No, because there was three of them whose names started with R. Like, yes. How was I supposed to figure? And they were all brown skin
they all
or dark
got the
skin.
Same name.
It didn't make any sense.
Ralph, Ronnie, y'all.
Ricky,
got the same, uh-huh.
Bobby. Their names all ended in a little E sound. It was too confusing.
I'm sorry. Y'all needed a little name switch. Mm-hmm. But throughout the whole thing, I had like a picture of the actors and the real people, and then I had to name so I could keep everything together so I wouldn't be confused. But I was surprised by how good it was. I came to school, like, after the weekend, everybody watched it. And I came to school Monday, and all you heard was, Candy Girl.
Yes.
You're all my world. Shout out to me. But you heard that Candy Girl. You heard, Mr. Telephone Man. You heard, and what was the other one? I'm sorry, my youngest.
One that they were really sleeping on was the one at the beginning of the third part where they're like the music video where they're all like in the gym and the Asian girl turns on the boombox.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about when they were all in the studio and they were.
Can you stand the rain?
Can you stand the rain?
Yes.
That's the part. I know everybody was singing that too. I kept singing it and my mom would be like, okay, Khalees. It's over now. You got to stop saying
no.
It.
All we did was listen to Spotify put out a This Is New Edition playlist, and it has, like, all their greatest hits. That's all we've been listening to since this movie came out.
I haven't been hyping it that much, but it was good, BET. Shout out to you. So on to our next in Black Excellence. We're going to talk about my role model, who is only 4 years old, but Dalia Marie Arana has read over 1,000 books. At the age of 4, I'm 16 and I haven't done that yet. But she's from Gainesville, Georgia, and she has been reading since she was 2. And she now, at the age of 4, she reads on a college level. When she was 2.5, her mom enrolled her in a program that encouraged toddlers to read 1,000 books before kindergarten, and she completed the program for children who were older than her. She has read over 1,000 books and invited to the Library of Congress last month and was librarian for the day. I read the article and I saw the little pictures and it was the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life. They had her and the librarian walking through and it was just a young Black girl looking up to a Black woman who she probably wants to be in the foot of, like, following her footsteps one day. And I was about to cry. It was so pretty. It really touched my soul. But Dalia loves reading books about dinosaurs and wants to become a paleontologist one day when she grows up. And I think she should just be everybody's role model. She's read over 1,000 books at the age of 4. There's some, like, 50-year-olds out there who haven't done that.
That's true.
Let's aim to be Dalia in our life. Okay.
I love her. That's all I have to say about the topic. Like, I love her.
It is amazing. There was a video of her reading at the age of 2. And I don't know when that, what the average age is when you start reading. But at the age of 2, she was reading how some people used to read in second grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed. And so, like, I don't know how it is for some people, but I had, like, the little, I would go to my grandma's house before preschool, and so my grandma taught us everything before, but that's not how it is for, like, all kids. They don't have people like that looking out for them sometimes, so they don't get it until, like, sometimes not even preschool, until, like, kindergarten or even first grade. So, I don't know. Honestly, even though she's 4, I think Dalia really is a role model for some people, and even, like, adults. Like, now you see what some people should be doing with their kids. I don't know if it's 1,000 books, but we should try at least.
Now we're going to transition to education justice. So we have 2 stories for you guys today. The first one is a local story. So last April in 2016, there was a 14-year-old boy who used to attend Woodland Hills High School, and he recorded a conversation between himself and a school counselor who was questioning him about the killing of one of his friends, and he later posted the video to social media. And he recorded the video because he felt like his rights were being violated because he was being interrogated without a parent present. The following September, he recorded a conversation, well, an altercation between him and the Woodland Hills principal, Kevin Murray, who threatened to punch him right in the face and knock his teeth down his bleep throat. In the same recording, the principal's also heard saying that if they go to court, it'll be his word versus the student's, and his word will win every time. So the student complained to his mother and to other teachers at the Woodland Hills School, saying that Principal Murray had been threatening him and nobody believed him. So after he recorded the altercation and he showed it to his mom, everybody realized that he'd been telling the truth. So they made the recording public, and it was around that time that the DA's office decided to press felony wiretapping charges against him for the April recording with him and the school counselor. So since this incident, Principal Murray, he had been on paid leave for a little while. And so since then, he's been reinstated and he was given an undisclosed punishment. And he's also, in addition to being the principal, he is an assistant football coach at the school. And so, like I said, the 14-year-old boy is facing felony wiretapping charges. And I also think it's important to note that he has special needs. And so he will be having a preliminary hearing for these charges on February 27th, and his family has pulled him out of the school because they don't want him to be around the principal on a daily basis. And currently, organizers from the Alliance for Police Accountability and other partner organizations are pushing for the DA to drop the charges against the student and fire the Woodland Hills principal. So we really thought this story was really important to share because this is, first of all, this is a black student. This is a disabled student. And although he is a boy, he is being pushed out of school and he's being criminalized for trying to defend himself, trying to defend his rights, fighting against abuse in his school. Like this, I mean, this is basically everything we've been talking about since the beginning of the school year wrapped mm-hmm. into one.
So here's my thing on it. If nobody's going to look out for the students, it's up for the students to look out for themselves. And that's what we're told, and that's what people tell us, like, you have to look out for yourself and everything. Like, if something's wrong being done against you, then you're supposed to stand up and fight against it. Well, a 14-year-old boy fought against it, now he's facing felony charges. If you're being threatened by your principal on multiple occasions, do you actually think it's wrong to record your principal saying this? Do you think, if you're being questioned as a 14-year-old boy in a room with a bunch of adults without your parents, do you think it's wrong for him to have some type of proof of what was going on? So, like the principal said, nobody will believe him. They'll just take the adult's word. So is it really that crazy of him to record something just in case something comes up and, like, he said this, he said that? He's like, no, actually, this is what I said. Is it that bad for a student to stand up for their rights? Is it, like, deserving of a felony charge? I've had situations where it's flipped around and the teachers are recording me. At school, I'm standing in the hallway. Here's a teacher poking out her waist, poking out her hip, with her phone sticking out of it, recording us. if I was older in this situation, this happened in sixth grade. If I was older in this situation, I would have said something. I would have told my parents, like, why is she recording us? I did not give her permission to record me. My parents did not give her permission to record me. And I don't know what she's recording me for in the first place. So that could have been something I brought forward. There's another teacher who would just stand there with his arms crossed and his phone poking out as he's recording us. There's absolutely nothing wrong with those teachers recording us, but when it's flipped, when a student is recording something that's happening to him for his safety, it's completely wrong, and now we have to have charges brought against him. It's ridiculous. So if next time I report one of these teachers recording me, where's their felony charge? That's all I'm asking for. And they're a lot older than 14.
I have a lot of issues with this story. First of all, I don't understand why the school was questioning this boy about a homicide. Like, I don't see how that's their place at all. I didn't know that Woodland Hills was also the police department, but I guess they are. I'm also just not understanding, like, the whole... Well, I know that in Pennsylvania, it's illegal to record without both parties' consent. But I also think this is something that we talked about in the citywide meeting this month, that the world is changing very, very fast. And, like, especially with our generation, like, when something happens, the first thing we do is, like, record something, like, take a picture of something. Like, that's how things work. And, like, wiretapping, like, wiretapping charges, like, literally the term wiretapping comes from, like, when phones used to, like, have landlines and you would tap into somebody's wire. And, like, I don't feel like this is on the same level as that at all, especially with what you were saying. Like, if a teacher is being abusive to you, if a teacher is... like, saying something to you, like, obviously, when it goes through administration, like, teachers are going to look out for teachers at the end of the day. And how ageism works is that the older person is automatically the wise person, the correct person, the smart person, and the younger person is the one who's confused or lying or whatever. And, like, I've had similar situations. Like, I've had an ongoing issue with a teacher at my school, and every single time it gets back to another teacher, they automatically take the teacher's word for it because they're the teacher, they're the adult. And, like, at the end of the day, like, that's who they listen to. And so if it's going to take something like proof to get people to listen to him, like, I mean, they pressed charges because the video went public, but I don't see the issue with using these videos, like, internally. Like, you show the video to an administrator, you show the video to the school board, and they handle it internally. Because I can, the privacy issue, whatever, whatever, and, like, it makes the school look bad, but at the end of the day, the priority is the student. Mm-hmm. And so the student should be the one, like, the student should have a right to do whatever they have to do to protect themselves if the school's not going to do that job for them.
Mm-hmm. And then it's not even a teacher, it's the principal. So say this happened with a teacher, you'll go to the principal and be like, this is what happened. But it's the principal. Who are you going to? You have to take it higher. And if you take it higher, you need evidence. You need facts. Say, like, this is what happened to me. My principal told me he's going to punch me in my mouth multiple times. He has verbally abused me on several occasions. So what do you do? He did, in my opinion, the right thing. He recorded it, and he brought it to somebody. And there's nothing wrong with that. He was standing up for himself. He was looking out for himself, making sure that if he does go and say something, it's not going to be flipped. And the principal's like, oh, this was actually what happened. No, he took charge and he said, this is what happened and I'm going to prove it.
And he's 14. Like, mm-hmm. I've seen boys older than him who have, like, maliciously recorded people, maliciously taken pictures of people, and they're, oh, they're kids. Oh, they're teenagers. You know how this generation is. And he's defending himself from abuse, and it's like, oh, this is a felony charge. Like, that, to me, in and of itself, is because he is black and is because he has disabilities that they're automatically finding a reason. And then, like, the fact that these are felony wiretapping charges, not from the video that he recorded with the principal, but from the video that he recorded with the counselor, mm-hmm. like, to me, that's, there's a direct correlation between that. Like, this yeah. is a retaliation for him coming after the principal. Like, this is the school trying to punish him in some way for that. Mm-hmm. And the DA's office is being, like, not only complicit, but they're being a mule to, like, punishing a 14-year-old disabled child for defending himself.
The whole situation is outrageous. If you're pushing it so hard with your students not to record anything, do you need to start looking for the teachers recording students also all of the time? Maybe you should start checking their phones on their hip, poking out, recording all students in their class. I don't know, just a suggestion. It may be too wild for you to understand.
Okay, so for everybody who is listening and is eligible to vote, I need you to go out, whenever the next judge elections are. I'm not necessarily sure when that is. I don't think it's November. I think there's some time between now and then. Please go out and vote for different judges so that we don't continue to have these issues in this city. So, like, please just go out and do your job on that level. Like, I know that everybody's still really stressed out about the whole Trump thing, but also this little boy is suffering. And there's nothing anybody in the city can do about it besides the DA's office. So that's who we need to be coming for right now. So go out and vote so we have different judges so that we'll have a better DA's office.
Okay, so moving on in at Justice, we're going to be talking about Breisha Meadows. 15-year-old Breisha Meadows has been incarcerated for 191 days and counting. For years, she lived in fear and watched her father physically abuse her mother and threaten to kill her entire family. Her grades dropped and she ran away from home seeking help. Last July, Breisha shot and killed her father while he slept. Her mom calls her her hero and she wasn't strong enough. Her mom calls her her hero and says she wasn't strong enough to get out. Prosecution has decided to try her as a child, but she's still facing aggravated murder charges for defending her family from abuse. An update on it, Breisha recently was transferred to a treatment facility that allows counseling and mental health services. Though it's better than juvenile detention, we still have to understand that she is still being confined. A number of questions come up in this situation. The biggest one coming up for me is, why is she being treated as the one who did the wrongdoings instead of a victim? Why are they not helping her? Why are they punishing her instead of helping her? She's 14, she's 15, and had to live through years of abuse. She has to live with that for the rest of her life. And instead of trying to make it easier for her and instead of trying to help her, they threw her in juvenile detention. Like, you're being tried with this and you're being tried with that. Why is the criminal justice system punishing survivors of abuse instead of referring them to resources for healing? It's just an overwhelming question.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, the American criminal justice system is a penal system. It is not here for restorative justice. It's not here. I don't really feel like for justice in any way, shape, or form. I feel like at the end of the day, like, somebody needs to be punished if something happens. Like, you know what I mean? They need to. It's a reactionary system. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily, like, a reparative system. I mean, there are plenty. There's not just Breisha. But, like, Breisha is one of the most egregious examples of children. There's women who are in jail for killing their abusive partners. There's women who have been murdered because they've gone to the quote-unquote criminal justice system looking for restraining orders, looking for justice against men who've abused them, and they've been turned away. Exactly like what we were talking about with the wiretapping case. Nobody believes you unless there's evidence. And there's never really a way to obtain evidence that, like, falls within the law. Like, the laws are set up in a way that, like, they aren't really here to help the victims as much. Like, and it comes to a point when, like, men are killing their children, when men are killing their wives for people to actually, like, do something, but that's only after the damage is done. And, like, people who try to get out of those situations, like, this especially happens a lot with, like, women who try to leave abusive partners, but they can try to leave, like, even if the woman was strong enough, like, if Breisha's mother was strong enough to leave, like, who's to say that man wouldn't have found them and killed them the next day?
I mean, Breisha's mom in 2011, she actually filed a domestic violence protection order against her husband, and she said in the order, like, she's 100% fearful that if he finds them, he's going to kill her, he's going to kill all her children. They said her grades were dropping, like, the school, what were they doing? They're supposed to be here to look out for that type of thing. So you see the student, everything, like, her grades are dropping, they're becoming bad. Why are you not saying, like, hey, what's going on in your life? Why are there not people looking at this type of things in their school saying, like, Breisha, do you need to talk? And if there was that person who was saying, like, Breisha, do you need to talk, there's a chance that Breisha would not be locked up right now, that she would be out, her mom would be safe, her siblings would be safe from her father, and something would have happened. Instead of her being treated as a criminal in a case where she saved her family.
And then another question that came up with this is, what kind of education is Breisha and the other girls like her getting in the juvenile detention facility and even in the mental health facility that she's been transferred to? Because she's already missed more than half of a school year. She's 15 years old, so at this point she's in high school. And that's a really crucial part of her education, that her getting left behind on top of all the abuse that she's been dealing with, on top of her grades dropping because of the years and years of abuse prior, she can, I mean, like, there's a possibility that she might not recover if she's not getting the correct educational support while she's incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. It's a question of, like, do people just not care? Do you just not care that this girl had to deal with years of abuse? She had to watch her mom deal with years of abuse. She had to watch her mom deal with broken ribs, broken noses, and all this. She had to sit through her dad threatening to kill her. And, like, she's locked up right now, or she's in this place, and are there people out there looking to see, like, the people within the system, not people out here trying to help Breisha, are there people within the system looking and saying, like, well, while she's in here right now, while we're fighting to get her out, is she getting the education that she needs? Or is all this happening for her? Is she getting the help? Is she getting the mental help that she needs? Instead of just saying, oh, she's a criminal, she killed her father.
And I think, like, it really is telling to me the fact that the system was so quick to punish her for killing her father, like, to get justice for an abuser. Mm-hmm. And not to even try to, like, find a way to, like, I mean, they have so many loopholes and, like, so many ways to get people out of things. And the fact that they would automatically just write off a 15-year-old girl. And, like, this isn't even her burden to bear. Like, she didn't ask to be brought into this world. She didn't ask to have the father that she had. She didn't ask to grow up with the abuse that she got. She did what she could with what she had. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the system punishes her for her reaction to a situation that she, nobody knows the correct way to deal with a situation like that. Even people who have been through that situation, there's no right way to handle something like that. It's just, it is what it is. And, like, at the end of the day, everybody suffers. But the fact that the system was so quick to find justice for her father, to find justice for an abuser, to find justice for a violent man, and not to find justice for her, like, really, really blows me.
And I read an article where Breisha's aunt was talking, and she said there had been several meetings with, like, CPS to see what was going on inside the house. But in all the meetings, they interviewed her mom with her father right next to them.
Yes.
They never took the mom out just to talk to the mom. Because the mom, Breisha's mom, already knew, like, if she said all this in front of her father, she'd have to pay for it. Her children would have to pay for it. So, the system is just skipping over little steps that needs to be taken. It should be mandatory that you speak to each parent separately if you know you're dealing with abuse within the household. So if you just go in there, you ask them what's going on, you sit the mom down with the dad, when you believe, like, when people have told you that the dad is abusing the whole family and the mom, why wouldn't that be, like, why doesn't that pop up in your head to say, okay, let's separate everybody and get the real story? Why do you just come in his house saying, oh, everything looks fine, as you interview the mom with the dad, and just leave? And leave Breisha and her mom and her siblings in the situation. I mean, like, there's so many missteps in this story. There's so many times it could have been fixed. There's so many times when she ran away, when her grades dropped, when she had all the CPS meetings. There's so many times it could have been fixed, but it was just skipped over because the system is horrible. It's set up horribly. So if you want to help and if you want to support, you can follow at Free Breisha, Breesha, on Twitter for updates, or go to freebreisha.wordpress.com. So next we're going to have expressions, and we have Miss Sarah from Teen Block reading the bridge poem by Donna Kate Rushen.
I've had enough. I'm sick of seeing and touching both sides of things. Sick of being the damn bridge for everybody. Nobody can talk to anybody without me, right? I explain my mother to my father to my little sister to my brother to the white feminist to the black church folks to the ex-hippies to the black separatists to the artist to my friend's parents. Then I've got to explain myself to everybody. I do more translating than the goddamn UN. Forget it. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of filling in your gaps, sick of being your insurance against the isolation of your self-imposed limitations. Sick of being the crazy at your holiday dinners, sick of being the odd one at your Sunday brunches, sick of being the sole black friend to 34 individual white people. Find another connection to the rest of the world. Find something else to make you legitimate. Find some other way to be political and hip. I will not be the bridge to your womanhood, your manhood, your humanness. I'm sick of reminding you not to close off too tight for too long. I'm sick of mediating with your worst self on behalf of your better selves. I am sick of having to remind you to breathe before you suffocate your own full self. Forget it. Stretch or drown. Evolve or die. The bridge I must be is the bridge to my own power. I must translate my own fears, mediate my own weaknesses. I must be the bridge to nowhere but my true self, and then I will be useful.
Too relatable.
Thank you, Miss Sarah. That was amazing.
That hit me in my gut. Just to wrap up with some quick announcements for anybody applying for college this year. Needs scholarship last dollar grants. The information is going to be put up this month. So check their website. It's need.ld.org. You can check for that specific scholarship, and then they'll have other scholarships available as well. And then make sure to complete your 2017 to 2018 FAFSA if you haven't already. So you can now use the what they call the prior year tax return information to submit your FAFSA. So that's really, really helpful. So make sure you do that so you can get those coins and go to college.
That concludes this episode of The Block on Youth Express, recorded live from Saturday Light Brigade. Special thanks to Sarah Sablack and Chanessa Schuller. We welcome your feedback and input. Follow us on Twitter at teen_block.
Youth Express, catch the future.